You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
Eating is one of the most basic human needs. Human survival has traditionally depended on our ability to find or grow food ourselves, or to exchange something of similar value to acquire it. But those simple equations are now severely out of whack, as speculation on food as a form of investment has completely altered the world food economy. As a result of food price spikes in 2008, a United Nations study estimated that 130 million additional people experienced malnutrition throughout the developing world. And the threats of unaffordable food for the most vulnerable are not behind us, with prices exceeding the 2008 levels for most of the past year. James Heinz is a research professor at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's just published a paper with Jayati Ghosh and Robert Pollan exploring the connections between speculation on commodity futures markets and the destabilization of global food prices, and he joins me this morning. Hello, James.
Hello.
Your colleague Jayati Ghosh has called the relationship between food and global finance an unnatural coupling. What does she mean?
Well, I think to really understand what she means by that, I think it's important to recognize that most of the commodity speculation that we're talking about doesn't actually involve the buying or selling of the physical commodity. It doesn't involve the buying and selling of wheat or corn or soybeans, for instance. What it involves is the buying and selling of these things called futures contracts. And what a futures contract is, it's an agreement to either buy or sell a commodity at a fixed price at some point in the future. And there's always two parties to each futures contract. One of the parties agrees to make delivery of the commodity in the future, and the other agrees to accept delivery of the commodity in the future at the specified price on a specified a date. And the original purpose of all these contracts, these futures contracts, was to provide a kind of insurance policy for farmers, because farmers, when they plant wheat, they don't know what price the price is going to be when they actually harvest the wheat. And so this was a way for them to kind of lock in a price and remove the risk of price fluctuations. And the counterparty would kind of be like an insurance company, providing that insurance to farmers. But what's happened, and what Jayati is alluding to, is that the markets have fundamentally changed in the past 10 years. And what we've seen is just an enormous entry of large banks and large investment companies entering into futures markets and taking large positions. And often the positions that they would take positions in which they would benefit if commodity prices, food prices, would go up in the future. And when you have a large number of investors entering a market that in a way that didn't exist before, and they're all betting that food prices are going up, the prices in those futures markets do go up. It's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And this has nothing to do with the exchange of the underlying commodity. But when these futures prices do go up, what it does have an impact on is the prices in what we would call the spot market. And the spot market is the market in which the commodity is actually exchanged, the actual physical commodity. So we have all this speculative activity that doesn't involve the actual commodity itself, not the physical commodity at all. It's a pure financial type of either a gamble or a financial strategy. And that's what's impacting the food prices.
What drives all of this trading?
Well, the history of it, it's just, you know, the entry of these large players into these markets really happened over the past 10 years. And what happened around that time was there was some research within the financial community that showed that if investors invested in these markets and they adopted positions in a wide range of different commodities, agricultural commodities, petroleum and other energy commodities, precious metals and so forth. So they take a wide range of positions. The research showed that they could actually mimic the returns that they got by investing in the stock market. And what was more important is that when the stock market wasn't performing very well, the returns in the commodity markets tended to perform better than the stock markets. So what happened is we had the dot-com bubble in the 1990s. We had the subprime mortgage investment and all of that speculative activity. And when the stock market went sour and the real estate market started to go sour, all these investors turned to the commodities markets as a way of kind of continuing their investment and continuing to make these types of returns. And that happened around 2005, 2006, when you really saw the massive increase in these markets. And that corresponded with the rapid rise of prices, food prices, and also, you'll remember at the same time, petroleum prices and other commodity prices also went up at the same time, all of a result of this kind of changing investment strategy that took place.
Can you give us an example of how this kind of trading has affected a particular food, like wheat or corn or soybeans?
Very, very clearly. In those markets, wheat markets, and let's think back to around 2006, 2007, because that was the first round of the price hikes. They're happening again, but that gives us kind of a historic example. At those times, we saw prices increase dramatically. They either doubled or tripled in all of these markets. So just going up dramatically, and that had a ripple effect throughout all food prices because the markets are very connected. So quite literally, you would see people who were very dependent, particularly on staple foods, or people who spent a large portion of their budgets on food, low-income people in developing countries, literally seeing the cost of that food doubling, tripling in just a matter of a few months. And this was one of the driving forces behind some of the malnutrition statistics that you cited in the in introduction and just kind of the growing pressure on people's incomes that led to higher poverty rates in many parts of the world.
James, who are the winners and who are the losers in this game of food investment?
Well, the winners, clearly the investment community, the financial institutions, were able to, move into these markets and out of the stock market when those investments were souring. So they were able to kind of continue their kind of stream of profitable investment by hopping from one market to the next market. And so clearly they benefited by the investment opportunities that these markets provide. In the developing world, I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I don't think it's right to talk about this benefiting investors in kind of the rich industrialized north and hurting the countries in the global south. Because many of the countries in the global south specialize in exports of these commodities, and so the producers of those commodities in these countries actually did benefit by the commodity booms. Growing copper prices really benefited countries like Chile and Zambia and so forth. But the people who were dependent on the commodities for just surviving on a day-to-day basis were hurt. So you see the producers of the commodities benefiting, and those producers might actually be in the same countries of the people most adversely affected by this commodity boom. So it's not a simple question of this country won and that country lost. Clearly, producers and investors tended to win, and low-income families and households tended to bear an enormous brunt of these rising prices.
Your paper ends with a call for regulation to limit the trading volume on futures markets. Can you talk about that and why you recommend that?
Yes. So how these markets have been regulated, to the extent that they are regulated, largely these markets are not regulated, or a lot of the markets are not regulated. Some of the markets that are regulated are the agricultural markets, and there are often limits called position limits that are set that limit the amount of investment a single trader can have in any given market over a given period of time. And by limiting the amount of investment that a single trader can have, it prevents this type of phenomena where you have large investment banks entering a market and just overwhelming the market dynamics. So by setting these positional limits, you don't get rid of speculation in the market, but you kind of try to control its harmful effects or the effects of it really distorting the markets. There's actually been some progress on this, or at least there's been movement on it, I should say. The financial reform legislation that was passed in the United States, the Dodd-Frank legislation, called for an overhaul of the rules governing commodity futures trading. And some of the major future markets are located in the U.S., so this is very important. Just this past week, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is the federal agency that is responsible for regulating these markets, proposed a whole new set of position limits, both on agricultural commodities, but also on commodities that had not been regulated before directly through this federal body, which includes all the energy markets as well. And so there are new rules that have been proposed. They're on the table. Now we have to see whether they're actually going to take hold. There's going to be a big battle over this in the coming months. And the financial institutions have already started condemning the announcement of these rules. But it's those type of changes that we need to see happen.
James, where do you think that people can put political pressure most effectively to push forth these regulations and to help to stabilize global food prices?
Well, I think, you know, within the United States, where a lot of the rules are made, people working, you know, at institutions like mine, the Political Economy Research Institutes, the activist groups like Americans for Financial Reform, they've been really active, commenting on these rules as they're announced, and really trying to put forward the case that these rules need to be implemented. They need to be strong. The exemptions from these rules have to be limited. The problem is that the futures markets that drive these dynamics are concentrated in a few countries, and the rules are set in those countries. And so people outside of the United States don't actually have the opportunity to set the rules governing these financial markets that are affecting their livelihoods, the commodities on which that they need to survive, and so forth. So the big markets are based in Chicago, they're based in New York, they're based in London, and that makes it very difficult because the regulation of these markets has to happen within those countries. So again, I think, you know, putting pressure on where it is, but recognizing that this is the reality of the situation, and it makes it difficult, for instance, you know, if you're thinking of what can Canadians do to change these rules? The reality is that what would have to happen is Canadians need to the best that they can put pressure on the U.S. government to actually change the rules.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, James, and I really appreciate your ability to explain these complex issues in a way that we can really grasp.
Oh, no problem. I've enjoyed talking to you as well.
I've been speaking with James Heinz. Heinz is a research professor at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.